You're watching Straight Talk Africa. Hello, I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you for joining me. As African nations step up their COVID-19 vaccination drives, health officials worry that getting shots in arms will not be easy, thanks to another kind of super spreader, social media misinformation. This week, we ask, is fake news hurting Africa's vaccination efforts? And should social media companies take greater responsibility for the falsehoods flourishing on their platforms? We'll also discuss the power struggle between big tech, politicians, and the public over who controls what is said and seen on social media. We'll have news, analysis, and your opinion. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Once seen as a vaccine hoarder, the United States is now sharing its COVID-19 shots, acting on the White House's pledge to deliver 500 million vaccine doses around the world over the next year. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on some of the African countries that have received their first batches.
Tanzania received its first batch of 1 million Johnson & Johnson doses. The country's new president was among the first to get the shot. Tanzania is one of the last African countries to receive a vaccine from any source, mainly because its former leader, who died in March, had claimed prayer could defeat COVID-19. Attitudes toward vaccination, however, are still mixed.
The action by the president to take a new direction in the battle against the coronavirus has brought relief to Tanzanians.
I am not willing to be vaccinated. Why don't we consider our traditional solutions? Why do we have to use foreign medicine?
Despite some Tanzanians' hesitancy, the health minister assures the vaccine is safe.
Tanzanians should come out confidently to be vaccinated.
The U.S. sent Burkina Faso more than 150,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. U.S. Ambassador Sandra Clark attended a ceremony to hand over the supplies.
There will be more deliveries in the next weeks or months.
Burkina Faso's health minister was thankful.
These doses will be used to vaccinate the people that need it.
Akuna Cook of the U.S. State Department told VOA that more doses are on their way.
We will be delivering the largest doses to any country, to South Africa at 5.6 million doses, and then to Nigeria at just over 4 million doses.
But vaccination levels across Africa are low, with less than 2% of the continent's 1.3 billion population having received one shot, according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Cook says the U.S. is also helping in other areas.
We have invested in vaccine manufacturing in South Africa and in Senegal to ensure that Africa can then produce its own vaccines. We are also providing economic assistance to countries that have been impacted by COVID-19 with over $541 million in assistance.
Deliveries are being made from Africa to Argentina, where 3.5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine arrived last Saturday.
For us, to make sure that our neighbors on the region can contain COVID-19 is essential.
To have received this donation means to us reaching 36.5 million vaccines.
Argentina has inoculated almost half of its 45 million people with the first dose and almost 5.3 million with two. Nearly 105,000 people have died from the disease, according to officials. Colombia, with one of the highest infection rates in South America, also received the vaccine. Its president welcomed the shipment.
Today we received this marvelous gesture, and I want to express to you, President Joe Biden, our gratitude.
Colombia, a nation of 50 million, has reported nearly 120,000 deaths. And speaking in Singapore this week, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the Indo-Pacific region is also a priority.
The pandemic has reminded us how deeply our world is interwoven. Today, a threat to global health anywhere is a threat to security everywhere.
While many critics applaud the U.S.'s sharing of vaccines, they also say that the donations aren't enough and are no substitute for a plan to end the pandemic. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And as those vaccine doses are delivered across Africa and countries race to get shots in arms, health officials say they are running into problems of vaccine mistrust, hesitancy, and resistance. Now, a recent survey by the research institution Afrobarometer of five West African countries, Benin, Liberia, Niger, Senegal, and Togo, revealed that there's a connection between vaccine hesitancy and people's distrust of their country's leadership. In short, people do not trust the vaccine because they do not trust the government. The survey also shows that on average, 4 in 10 West Africans say they are likely to try and get vaccinated, with most people saying they simply do not trust their leaders to guarantee the vaccine safety. So we ran our own poll among Straight Talk Africa's Facebook followers, and we asked, would you take a COVID-19 vaccine if it is made available to you? Well, 53% of respondents said yes, and 47% said no. And I'm going to read some of the comments that came along with that poll. Oyugi Ronald Odongo from Uganda says, no, I will not take the vaccine. I will just build my immunity. I would take a vaccine made in Africa. Patrick Chipeta in South Africa says, it doesn't work. You get vaccinated. A few days down the line, you become sick and you die. So what's the point of taking it? You don't report the side effects of these vaccines. And after all, our bodies are temples of the living God. This vaccination has so many sinister issues behind it. Reagan Biamugisha from Uganda says, if developed countries care about us, why block Africa from buying exactly the same vaccine used on their citizens, but instead they want to simply donate it to us? And Namara Africa from Kenya says, a corruption vaccine would be the best in Africa. That is very funny, Namara. Well, the Africa Centers for Disease Control says false information on social media is also primarily to blame for vaccine mistrust and hesitancy. And health officials are worried about online COVID-19 super spreaders, disinformation, that is, of course, fake news spread intentionally, and misinformation, falsehoods people share unwittingly on social media. So how do you know if what you're seeing and sharing online is actually true? And how can you sort through what's fact, what's fake, and what's fiction, especially when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines? Well, for some answers, I spoke to a medical doctor, a data journalist who reports on the spread of information in the digital era, and a professional fact checker. Joining me this week is Dr. Joachim Chikomeko. He's a medical doctor originally from Uganda and is now with the Amsterdam University Medical Center in the Netherlands. And joining us from Kenya are Grace Gishui, a researcher with Africa Check, and Odanga Madung. He's a data journalist and analyst whose work focuses on how information is spread in the digital era. A warm welcome to all of you. Grace, can you kick us off here and give us a sense of how big the problem of false information on social media really is?
It is quite widespread, with more people owning mobile devices, such as smartphones. The rate of internet penetration in Africa is going higher, and more people in Africa will use their mobile devices for social media, meaning misinformation and disinformation will likely reach them, reach a large proportion of them often. Like, for example, there are crazy videos showing people who are claiming to show that people, after people are vaccinated, they start getting seizures. Others claim that their bodies, rather their skin, became magnetic. Just crazy, crazy, crazy claims. So definitely it's just gotten wild.
Dr. Chikomeko, I'd like to come to you. It seems we are not just talking about vaccine hesitancy, but in some cases, people's flat-out refusal to take the vaccine at all. With the patients you treat, the people you help and speak to, why do some people not trust the vaccine? What are they telling you?
Thank you very much, Heidi. We are seeing a lot of conspiracy theories, this time about the vaccine itself. And we're also seeing a lot of rumors on the Facebook, social media that are going on about vaccines. So many people come to me and they mention most of the rumors that Grace has also mentioned here as one of the reasons. But let's not forget that 90% of the vaccine we have in Africa is of one specific time, one specific type. We can mention it AstraZeneca. Almost all African countries are dependent on the COVAX program of UNICEF to get a vaccine, and 90% of it is AstraZeneca. In March and April, when this vaccine was being rolled out in Africa, unfortunately, this is the time that this vaccine faced a lot of negativity in the news, and most especially in Europe, because every day we saw one of the European countries that was suspending its use at that moment. And this is the time that we are also lowering the same vaccine in Africa. We know at the moment that most of the vaccine that we receive in Africa comes from India, like we have the European Medical Agency that is compared to the FDA in America. It hasn't recognized that specific AstraZeneca from Europe. What are we seeing is that some of the European countries are not even accepting people who have been vaccinated with that specific vaccine, the Covishield, to enter their countries. What message are we sending to the Africans who are only getting that specific vaccine? Because I usually talk to the people, different people from different organizations, government, or friends of mine. I grew up in Uganda. My Facebook of my WhatsApp is full of Uganda. I talk to them, I try to promote a vaccine, and the next day, I get a very genuine article where they state, many Africans, many Indians are not even allowed to enter Europe because they received Covishield, the only vaccine that people have in Africa. You see, in Europe, it is very easy. If one vaccine is not allowed, we can choose to the three different other options. But in Africa, it's not the same. So people are hesitant, not only because of the misinformation we see on Facebook, but also because of the negative information that they read about the vaccine that they have, and they don't have any other option.
And that is a very good point, Doctor. One doesn't realize that it's also about choice or lack of it, and that some people might feel backed into a corner or that one specific vaccine is being forced on them. I want to talk a little bit more about social media. Odunga, I read an op-ed you wrote recently in which you say that social media companies are standing in the way of Africa's vaccine rollout. What do you mean by that?
So the reason I say that in the article that I published is because, just as the good doctor mentioned, right, a big part of the vaccine hesitancy equation, right, is partly due to the kind of misinformation that people are seeing on social network or on social media platforms. It is not entirely responsible for all the vaccine hesitancy that we're looking at, but it certainly does play a significant role. Okay. Now, when you consider the dynamics of trying to get vaccines to the 1 billion Africans on the continent, some of the biggest headwind that we've been facing, and if you walk around here in Kenya, you'll be able to see it, is that vaccine centers are open. Some vaccines are there. They are there for eligible populations. But a lot of the eligible populations that are scheduled to go for those vaccines are not going for them. Why? Because they are afraid of the vaccine, or they do not believe it works, and they're hesitant towards it, or rather they have expressed hesitancy towards the efficiency of the vaccine. You know, it's not just necessarily about the fact that we're not able to get enough of the vaccines. I mean, only 2% of the African continent is vaccinated at this point. But the kind of hard work that it has taken to get that 2% to be vaccinated has been immense. And I wonder what it's going to be with the rest of the 98%. And so when you look at the rest of that population, you begin to understand how, you know, the failure to address the misinformation problem by the big tech platforms, in essence, is leading to a huge problem in terms of our vaccine rollout. Within Kenya itself, schools have reopened for a fresh calendar year in the country, but for some reason, close to 200,000 teachers in the country do not have vaccines, but they've still gone back to work. A big part of the reason why those 200,000 people have not gotten their vaccines is purely because they do not believe it works, right? And we must interrogate where, and after interrogations around where this missing, or rather where this hesitancy has come from, some of that a big part of that answer falls on the big tech platforms. It's spreading through WhatsApp. It's spreading through Facebook. When you search on YouTube for certain videos, a huge chunk of them are still there. So how do we address this specific problem? Because I think, as Joe Biden pointed out recently, these platforms, in essence, could actually be killing people.
Grace, in the work that you and your colleagues do at Africa Check, what do you know about who's behind the spread of the fake news we're seeing? I mean, some people are sharing false information innocently, but others have an agenda, right?
Well, there are multiple types of people who are behind the fake news, and their motivations for sharing the false information is also different. For example, there is the con artist who is out to make money. For example, a herbal specialist claiming to have a cure for COVID-19. There is also the conspiracy theorist who is just speculating, and people end up taking his or her speculations as gospel truth. There is also, as you said, friends and family who will share false information with the intention to share warnings of impending disaster out of goodwill. And the other group that we actually find sharing false information as well is people in positions of influence, e.g. politicians who will share false information to advance a political motive. When our deputy president got vaccinated. So when he got vaccinated, he was vaccinated with the Sputnik vaccine. At the time, people were paying for it in private hospitals. And it's a claim going around that the reason why Kenyans are not being, he wouldn't go for the free option is because he knows it's not as efficient as the Sputnik vaccine that he paid for. Of course, the people who are now spreading that kind of rumor is a person who has the intention to advance his or her political motive.
Odunga, what are you seeing in the work you do about the kind of actors that are at play here?
The biggest problem with when it comes to vaccine hesitancy that I have noticed is primarily, of course, starting from the religious side, right? So religious actors have been specifically notorious in terms of spreading vaccine misinformation, especially on social media platforms. And there's a lot of nuance as to how a lot of the misinformation that they spread ends up on the doorsteps, or rather on the inboxes, right, of the people that have access to these smartphones. Something that I like to call from the pulpit to the mobile phone, right? That when you consider the idea that many of the, at the height of the pandemic, many of the religious leaders within the African continent had already started voicing alarm bells about the vaccine. There have been various researchers that have found that as soon as the pandemic began setting foot within the continent, right, vaccine misinformation was already beginning to fester out, right? I don't know if any of you can remember the time when a bunch of French doctors were caught on TV saying that they would run vaccine trials, right, in Africa first before they would run them in the rest of the world. And to me, that was the nuclear bomb that created the context from which, you know, vaccine information, misinformation began to fester on very early in the pandemic, even before we had announcements of the vaccine making. The mark of the beast, Bill Gates and depopulation, and like a whole bunch of other conspiracy theories, and now begins to manifest and, you know, gather real momentum. And so One of the people that I have seen have been primarily and are still a huge part of vaccine misinformation purveyors are religious leaders, okay? And they are a very nuanced bunch to deal with because they're, you know, social media is not their only media touchpoint, right? Very many people share clips from the sermons that they show on TV onto their WhatsApp phones, onto their Facebook pages. And this is what I mean when I say from the pulpit to the mobile phone, right? Because whereas perhaps Facebook might have policies against vaccine misinformation, many of our TV channels, right? Many of our TV channels and of our, you know, media houses do not necessarily have those kind of policies, right? And perhaps will not fact check them in a live sense. And so when those clips end up now on people's mobile phones, they end up spreading like wildfire. Fact checkers do not fact check beliefs. And that is one of the reasons why, for the longest time before Facebook managed to get around dealing with this issue, right, a lot of religious misinformation was allowed to fester and manifest within the platforms, right, without being checked. Fact checkers cannot fact check the future, and they're not allowed to fact check beliefs.
Actually, I'm very happy that Brother Odang is mentioning religious leaders as one of the people spreading the information. But then we are talking about misinformation. It is very, very likely that religious leaders, actually misinformation is people spreading wrong information, not knowing that information they are spreading is wrong. My university, they did a study in Amsterdam. And what we found out is that 8 to 85% of the natives are willing to take the vaccines. But the immigrants in our community, of which in Amsterdam there are very many, how do we tackle this information? How do we go to this group? This is when you saw my video. This is one of the reasons that's why we decided to do a video too, because I'm involved in the African communities. I can reach the African communities. And the way my brother Odang says, African communities, we Africans are more believers than people here in Europe. So people, the Africans, the religious leaders are very much influential in this case. But what we've done, we've equipped religious leaders with the good information. What I see in Europe, what is being done is to fight this misinformation. Before we have the Minister of Health, who is every day, every hour on Facebook, every day updating what is happening. I'm a Ugandan, but I've been to different churches, being invited, most especially after my video, to talk about what I know. And at the end of the day, you see people, even the pastors themselves, changing because they ask you questions and you find that they are completely basing their views on the misinformation that they get. They told me that in the vaccine, it has a content of aborted children, and that for the Muslims, they say in the vaccine, they use cells from pigs. And you know, those misinformers are very, very wise. You see, they say aborted cells. You see, the Catholic and Christian, that is a no-go. When you talk about pig cells, for the Muslims, that is a no-go. And at the end of the day, they may begin preaching the right information we want to think, but we have to inform them, equip them with the good information.
Odunga, what are the steps that big tech companies can and should take to really clean up all this misinformation and disinformation on their social media platforms? Because if on the one hand we say the situation is desperate, it is out of control, and on the other hand we don't really want our government policing and placing strict restrictions on social media access, I mean, what else can be done to really eliminate the kind of dangerous and deadly information that's doing the rounds on these social media networks?
I do think that these guys need to perhaps donate money to vaccination literacy programs, right? Because of the kind of damage that they've done. I think there needs to be some reparations. As much as we might say that we do not want governments to police social media, we are all not comfortable with the idea of, you know, government looking into social media to try and check around what they are likely to say. But it has already started happening, right? Now, in terms of what these platforms perhaps can do, yes, we do need to invest in institutions that can hold these platforms to account, right? They cannot be judge, jury, and executioner. And I think even with the deplatforming of Donald Trump, many people are coming to a reckoning around that. So we need to invest in institutions that can be able to hold these companies to account and make sure that some of the effects that of the things that we're talking about, right, are not too pervasive and do not cause the kind of damage that that they are currently causing.
Grace, how can people verify the information that they are getting and seeing online? Can you help guide us in a way that would be useful for even the least savvy social media user?
Be skeptical when you see some information, especially when it's preying on your emotions. Does it make you angry? Does it make you scared? Such things. First of all, the thing you do is ask yourself, what is the source of this information? You verify the information by checking mainstream news organizations. And if you can't find it, especially in the case of breaking news, it's probably false. Always look out for the information going around from official organizations and fact-checking organizations in your country or in the continent. There you can be sure you'll find correct information. For COVID-19, some of the great choices would be Fast Draft, Africa Check, and AFP Fact Check. Those would be, I would advise people to actually look for correct information from such places.
Dr. Joachim Chikomeko in Amsterdam, Odanga Madung, and Grace Gishuhi in Kenya. Great to have your insights. I do appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. Thank you so much for your time. Now, if you want to verify the information that you're getting online, you can visit some of Africa's leading fact-checking websites like Africa Check, ZimFact, Ghana Fact, Nigeria's Dubawa, the DRC's Congo Check, and Pesa Check in Kenya. Follow them on social media. There's a lot of misinformation online that affects your health, your politics, and your finances, and these organizations have the resources to help you find and verify the facts. For more news and information about the COVID-19 vaccine and Africa's vaccination efforts, be sure to visit the VOA News website. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, we discuss the power struggle between big tech, politicians, and the public over who can tweet, who can delete, who can shut down, and who can crack down on social media. You're watching Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. We'll be right back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. When the Nigerian government shut down Twitter in the country indefinitely after the platform deleted a controversial tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari, it raised concerns about free speech in Africa's most populous nation. It also raised questions about whether America's big tech companies have too much power. Well, here in the United States, former President Donald Trump is now struggling to put himself back at the center of America's attention after he was banned on social media platforms. These lawsuits against Google, Facebook, and Twitter have highlighted the power of social media companies to control digital speech, even that of world leaders. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Since he left the White House, former President Donald Trump, who was booted from Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube after the January 6th Capitol riots, has struggled to get back in the spotlight. He tried a blog, and his allies launched two social media sites. He sued the big social media companies for constraining his right to free speech.
Our case will prove this censorship is unlawful, it's unconstitutional, and it's completely un-American.
Trump seems to have no problem drawing audiences, especially at rallies. Still, social media conversations and mentions about Trump dropped about 90% from January to May 2021, according to the head of Social Flow, who spoke to VOA.
And I think he's now realizing just how much he did lose in losing that audience. It's a big deal.
Worldwide, leaders are trying different methods for reining in the social media giants. The Nigerian government booted Twitter after it deleted a tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari. In India, Facebook's WhatsApp has sued the government to stop complying with new rules it says would lead to mass surveillance. In Russia, a new law requires social media firms to hire local staff if they want to advertise in the country. While leaders make decisions about online speech based on what's happening in their countries, some have likely taken note of Trump's ban by U.S. social media firms. Ethan Zuckerman, a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, told VOA.
I do think what's happened to Trump is a cautionary tale for the wannabe autocrats out there. What's not clear is exactly what lesson they're going to take from it. Do they go down the China path of trying to develop their own domestic social media that they have full control over? Or do they go down the Russia path where they say, look, we know people are going to continue expressing themselves on these international platforms. Let's figure out how to ensure that we have some leverage over them.
The power of social media giants to limit a person's speech is something that many are not comfortable with, experts say. Jillian York, director of International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, told VOA that what's needed are global standards for online speech and censorship, rather than what she calls the tech giant's current ad hoc country-by-country approach.
I think it's kind of a mess that we're in. It's not really either or at this point. It's, yes, other countries are watching Trump, but I think that what's, you know, what happens in other countries will affect what happens going forward in the U.S. too.
Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
So are big tech companies a major threat to world leaders and politicians, or vice versa? And who should decide what gets tweeted, what gets deleted, and what kind of access you have to social media platforms? That's the focus of my discussion with our guests. Ladies, thank you so much for joining me. Temi Ibirogba is an Africa policy researcher at the Center for International Policy. Also with me is Michelle Quinn. She reports for us from Silicon Valley and runs VOA's news bureau there. Ladies, welcome. I'm so happy to have you on the show. Michelle, we're going to start with you. We just saw your story about this. People often complain that politicians have too much power or try to wield too much power, especially when it comes to things like freedom of speech. But from what we've seen in your piece, this also begs the question, does big tech have too much power?
It's definitely the conversation that's happening now. It used to be not very long ago that everybody just thought the social media was great. It was a way for families to stay in touch, for politicians to speak to the constituents, for constituents to talk to politicians. And that has really changed almost in every single country, Europe, United States, and in key parts around the world, where politicians and even the people are starting to really say, does this service, is it serving society as, you know, greater good? And asking, does it have too much power? And should we try to kind of fit it into what we think is important? So this is a major shift that's really, really happened maybe, I would say, in the past 5-6 years, where people, but also elected officials, politicians are asking the same question. And even tech itself is sort of saying, yes, we know we need to be controlled. There are bad actors. But, you know, I'm not really sure how much they want that kind of the kinds of things that are happening around the world.
And Temi, is it a case of Twitter's Jack Dorsey versus your government, especially in the political space on the continent and around the world, really? Do these tech companies wield a sort of outsized power that ordinary people wouldn't really want the political establishment to have?
Yeah, in terms of whether these companies should have the outsized power that they do over political discourse in a country, I think social media is just a meeting place for public discourse in this digital age that we're living in. So it has less to do with the companies having power and more so to do with the people's power, which is their democratic right for freedom of speech, freedom of expression, etc. And of course, social media creates opportunities for disinformation and misinformation. But I think this is where the social media companies, their regulatory bodies should come in. So on Instagram, we've seen massive policy implementation where anytime COVID-19, for example, is mentioned, a banner features at the bottom of the post for users to access COVID-19 resources and then subsequently aid in the slowing down of misinformation. So I think that moves like this by social media giants, you know, it really begs the question of why the same can't be done for other types of things like racial abuse, for example, because, you know, the technology clearly does exist to monitor these types of things. And similarly, during the 2020 elections, social media platforms like Twitter and Instagram, they took it upon themselves actually to help control election-related information or misinformation rather, with banners on posts as well. So I think, you know, policymakers within the political establishment, they should work with these tech companies to make sure that the platforms are not inhibiting democracy through the spreading of false information. But the political establishment cannot take it upon themselves to ban these platforms because them doing that is, you know, anti-democratic. I think the power of the political establishment should be one of collaboration with social media companies.
Michelle, you've been reporting on governments that have tried to rein in these social media platforms inside their countries, and of course with varying results. Why do these countries choose to do it, and what have the consequences been?
All you have to do is look at what happened. Let's, for example, look at Myanmar. Facebook came into Myanmar and didn't really understand the country, and Facebook was used to, what can I say, facilitate genocide. People were spreading messages that Facebook did not understand or control, and the situation contributed to what happened in that country. So if you look around the world, countries like India are able to say to Facebook, wait, you need to respect our laws. And India in particular has created a whole bunch of new regulation for these social media companies. So for example, they have to have somebody who works in the country. They have to have all the data that belongs to people of India inside of India on servers in India. And the big one that's really been hard for the companies is if India says, you need to tell us the identity of a person who's made a controversial post, you have to do it or we can arrest you. And the countries and the companies have mostly towed the line. Twitter has pushed back, and WhatsApp, which is a Facebook company, has actually sued the Indian government saying, we can't comply with this. This goes against India's own constitution. So I see that happening there. Russia's kind of doing the same. We're not going to ban you, but we're going to try to control it a little bit. You know, then there's, of course, countries like China that have a very serious firewall where, you know, you're just not going to go in there.
And Temi, there is, of course, that glaring example of what has happened in Nigeria with President Muhammadu Buhari banning Twitter. What do you make of these two power centers flexing their muscles all over the place about who can tweet, who can delete, who can shut down and who can crack down?
Yeah, so in recent years, civil society space has continued to shrink, and democracy has also been on the decline in many African countries. And one of the symptoms of this is this trend of, you know, African leaders trying to control and rein in social media, like you said, as well as internet use, to repress the voices of the people. So examples of this include Nigeria, like you mentioned, as well as Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and actually at least 13 countries had implemented full or partial internet shutdowns in the first 6 months of 2021 alone. So in Nigeria, the Information and Culture Minister, Lai Mohammed, he claims that Nigeria is being used, or Twitter, excuse me, is being used for activities capable of undermining Nigeria's corporate existence. So the decision to ban Twitter actually came 2 days after the social media platform had deleted a tweet by President Buhari that seemingly threatened violence against Biafran secessionists. And for those who are not familiar, Nigeria had a three-year civil war, which began in 1967, in which the Igbo people fought to separate from the rest of Nigeria into a breakaway state known as Biafra. And this war led to the deaths of more than a million people in Nigeria. And it's understandably a sensitive topic for Igbo people, as many believe that the government has attempted to erase this part of Nigeria's history. So after Twitter deleted the tweet and Nigeria therefore banned Twitter, VPN usage in the country spiked because, you know, Nigerians are really trying to evade the ban, and it sparked an outcry and resistance among citizens. So on June 12th, which is Democracy Day, which happened to just be a few days after the ban was implemented, you know, people went out into the streets and protested. The ECOWAS regional court, they have ruled against the ban, saying that it's unconstitutional. And many countries and bodies like the US, UK, the EU, they've condemned the ban. And as of today, because you mentioned the economy, the Nigerian economy has lost over $366.88 million as a result of the Twitter ban. So it really shows the consequences are both socioeconomic, because it's the removal of a tool that citizens use to spread information about voting and about elections, but also economic, because many merchants and sellers, they convene on Twitter to sell their goods.
And we'll have more from Temi Ibirogba from the Center for International Policy and VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn after the break. You're watching Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Stay with us.
We're not saying that Twitter is threatening the country or any such thing like that, and that is not the justification.
We believe in human rights, freedom of speech, but all that also has to be used where freedom of speech is concerned responsibly, and where that is not the case, the government obviously has to measures.
Particularly for us who are in the media business, because almost every media house in Nigeria today has an account with Twitter, that connection you usually would have on that platform is no longer there.
We fear that if government does not rescind this directive and correct the harm that had already gone out, they could be leading to more human rights violations, as people would want to challenge this suit in court or on the streets through protests.
It's not that the president was banned from Twitter. A particular tweet of the president was restricted, was removed from Twitter. I think the reaction on the part of this government is just inappropriate and unnecessarily too strict. And it sends very wrong signals, and it's against the interest of Nigeria.
If it gets to a stage whereby there is no social media, I would really pick up my CV and start looking for job opportunities and how to fix myself into the code, how to fix myself into the society, and how to earn a livelihood, because social media is where I is.
And you've been listening to the Nigerian foreign minister explain the government's stance on the Twitter ban and Nigerians reacting to the Twitter shutdown. And that's what we talk about next as we continue our conversation with VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn and Temi Ibirogba from the Center for International Policy. Now, Temi, we've seen there how this Twitter ban isn't just about shutting down political issues and activities, but really also holds real-life consequences for ordinary people who use it to run their businesses, earn a living. These are the risks for them. But what's the risk for the Nigerian government here? And what's the message, whether intended or not, that other countries on the continent and around the world could potentially be taking away from this?
I think the message that's being sent to other parts of the world is one of authoritarianism. So Nigeria is joining the ranks of other places like North Korea, who have also done similar bans. And economically, I think it's sending a really bad message. Like I mentioned, you know, the Nigerian economy has lost millions of dollars because of this. So I think it's almost showing lessons for other countries. Like if you do ban Twitter, for example, it's going to have dire economic effects on individuals who use social media as a marketplace for their small businesses. And I think it's also showing a lesson of how important it is for social media companies and governments to work in a collaborative fashion rather than this, you know, the government is the one making the sole decision. In our constantly evolving digital age, it's really important to uphold democracy. And I think the way Nigeria has gone about this is a lesson of exactly what you shouldn't do.
And ladies, of course, you know, there have been instances of where social media in society has been used, you know, the powers have been used for good and in other cases for not so good. Michelle, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, some of the examples that you've come across in your reporting of where social media has been a really productive and good tool to use in society and where it has really been dangerous, not just for people, for communities, but also for people's personal safety and well-being?
The big example is, of course, like I mentioned before, Myanmar. So as Facebook was in Myanmar, didn't really monitor what was going on there, and the service Facebook was used to spread hate about the Rohingya people, and that contributed to the genocide. And the UN, in its report, found that Facebook played a role in that. Before it even knew exactly what was going on, it was already used. We've never really had a position like this where one person can speak to many so fast. We have TV, radio, we have other media, but nothing quite like social media. And with Facebook, which I think has like nearly 2 billion people on it, you can imagine how quickly a message could spread. And that is just one example. You know, some people would argue that in the United States, the same thing happened in here in this country around the election, that people believed that Donald Trump won. The message was all over Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and that contributed to kind of what happened on January 6th. I don't know if I agree that you can actually draw that line from social media to January 6th, but people are finding each other in communities there. And it's one of the criticisms of the platforms is they have these little recommendation engines. So if you're interested in sewing, you will find the others. It learns what you like. Well, if you're interested in conspiracy theories and want to overthrow the government, one of the criticisms of Facebook is you didn't have to go look for it. They would recommend it to you. So if you're sitting in Michigan and want to talk to somebody about insurrection, Facebook was offering this up. Now, Facebook has seriously cracked down on that kind of stuff and that recommendation engine. But those sort of incidents are happening all around the world, or potentially, and that governments have to worry about this, you know, with mainstream media, there were checks and balances and corrections and fact checking. So the social media companies have not wanted to get into fact checking because the scale is so big, meaning that there's so many messages, so much content, you can't do it. But what they are doing now is they're going to crack down on COVID and also, you know, sometimes election lies by certain kind of big players. I guess what I wanted to go back to this idea of colonialism, and that's been a big theme in India. In India, people who care about the internet are also looking at Facebook, Twitter, Google, and saying, why do they get to decide the rules back in California or on the West Coast of the United States? Isn't this more like a colonial power coming in and basically taking over? And so they're also saying, you know, you can come into our country, but you can't be an arrogant Western country and not comply and just say, well, we know better. You need to engage with us. And that can mean bumps, which is what some people might say is happening in India right now, disagreement. So this idea of an outside power where decisions are made thousands of miles away, having a dramatic effect in your own country, which, you know, and what kind of recourse do you have, is an issue that's really playing around in all areas of the world right now.
And Timmy, if you look at it this way, this is another sort of influence or a product or company from the West exerting whatever power it has and influence it has on the continent, which is something that people across Africa have been known to rail against. Should there be specific checks and balances on big tech, and what should that look like?
Yeah, I definitely think there should be checks and balances. I think I mentioned before, a collaborative approach between governments and social media companies is really important. So figuring out collaboratively, like, how do we stop disinformation, misinformation? I think that's really important because, of course, you know, social media is a space where things can spread that aren't true, or violence can be incited. So those are like the really, you know, negative aspects of it. But also, if you're thinking about the positive aspects of social media, it's just, you know, absolutely insane. It's a place for people to convene and have public discourse, spread information. Economically, it really has a lot of power as well. NSARS is one of the greatest case studies of, you know, how citizens can come together and convene on a social media platform in order to raise their discrepancies with the government and, you know, really let the world know how they feel.
Politicians use social media as well to interact with their constituents, to campaign, and ordinary people, the voters, protesters are able to organize, raise money and express their views and their dissatisfaction with government and business in a way that people, you know, were not able to do, say, 20 years ago. Do you see this tussle, Temi, between political leaders and big tech getting worse? Or will it get better as we become smarter about how to use social media more productively and better handle its impact?
Yeah, in terms of who gets to say what, a lot of Nigerians felt that it was very hypocritical for the Buhari administration to ban Twitter in the first place because he ran his election widely on social media and like used it as a big tool for getting the young people, you know, to vote for him. But now he's saying, oh, because you youth, Nigerian youth, want to speak out against me, I'm going to ban it. So it was just quite hypocritical. And just to touch on what we were saying about, you know, examples of it being dangerous for democracy or for society, you know, like I said, the benefits are definitely a meeting place for citizens to engage in critical information sharing related to political, social, economic, election issues. And the Arab Spring actually will always really be like an excellent case study for how social media can be used for revolutions, but it also showed us the limitations. You have countries like Tunisia, which was the catalyst for the Arab Spring, but it's currently facing political and democratic turmoil 10 years later. And I always say that like the Arab Spring walked so that NSARS could run in a way, because it provided like a blueprint for virtual civil society organizing. You know, social media can also help to save lives during protests because people with legal and medical connections can help to organize ambulances or jail bailouts for, you know, affected protesters. But like I said, the Arab Spring is a dichotomy. You know, while social media is cited for as one of the key reasons for the revolution's success, long term, whether or not, you know, it's actually a success remains a question. You have various African countries like Egypt and Libya and Tunisia who are still facing extreme issues today. And those issues are really dangerous for the society and, you know, affect the safety of its people, of their well-being. I think it just really shows us the difference between like the drivers of mass protests and the actual institutional and systemic changes. So just because a pro-democracy movement can help organize an uprising and using social media as a key tool to do that, it doesn't always mean that that same movement is gonna win elections or change state institutions, which are really, you know, the next steps after protests. So that's just kind of to speak on, you know, how it can be dangerous if there's no kind of plan for after the organizing on social media.
And Michelle, that's probably really what I want to get to, where social media ends and real life begins. Does it matter what happens between Donald Trump and, you know, his sort of lawsuit against big tech? Everyone seems to now have their own examples and run-ins with these social media platforms and companies. Are other leaders really watching closely to see what happens in this case?
I think the lesson for the rest of the world, it depends what kind of lesson you're looking for. If you're a kind of a leader in a country and you're kind of leaning authoritarian, I think you would say to yourself, I'm not waiting for protests. I'm just going to figure out how to turn the internet on and turn the internet off, or go this other route, the India route, which is we're going to start trying to figure out how to, you know, make this body, this powerful force, more accountable. So that's one thing I think is the lesson if you're an authoritarian. I think for the United States, I think that there's just still a shock, kind of, that a president of the United States was shut down, violated some social media norms, and was deplatformed, as we put it, pushed off the platforms. Now, Donald Trump can always, he can go on Fox today, he can even start his own radio program, TV show, social media, whatever. He's got a lot of power and a lot of followers, no matter what he decides to do. But what is interesting is if he wants to reach beyond that base, those people are on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and being blocked from there is probably going to hurt him as he tries to do whatever he tries to do next. Perhaps he's thinking about running again. So I think the lesson for somebody who's like interested in retaining power is get control of social media. And maybe if you are very serious about democracy, whether you're a member of the public or you are a politician, we need to figure out how to protect these organizations that really haven't thought very seriously about how to deal with misinformation coming from elected leaders who have credible power. So I think we're just in this really interesting time in the world where stuff's happening in the United States, but the U.S. is looking to Nigeria, India, other countries, and seeing what they're doing and how they're taking this thing that I think we agree can be incredible and trying to shape it or control it. And sometimes, as was happening in Nigeria, as Temi said, you're sort of shooting your economy in the foot. You kill Twitter and you're hurting people in so many different ways. So it's not a very popular decision.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for your insights. We're going to leave it there. Michelle Quinn, the Voice of America's Silicon Valley Bureau Chief, and Temi Ibirogba, an African policy researcher at the Center for International Policy. Ladies, thank you both for joining me. Great to have you on the show. Join me on the next Straight Talk Africa as we celebrate the records, the medals, and the victories of Africa's greatest athletes at the Tokyo Olympics. We'll look at what it would take to bring the Olympics to Africa. The continent has hosted big sporting events before, but it has yet to land the world's greatest athletic competition. We'll look at what kind of investment would be needed and whether Africans really want to host the games. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And on behalf of the Straight Talk Africa team, I want to say congratulations and well done to all the athletes who made their countries and the African continent proud at the Tokyo Olympics. We have so much to celebrate. So whether you're watching from across Africa or elsewhere in the world, thank you for always watching and always listening to Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Until next week,